Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio program. My name is Keith Pannell, and today we're going to be talking about forensic science, toxicology, and we've got two guests today. One is Dr. Vanessa de la Rosa, who's currently at the University of New Mexico and doing all sorts of interesting toxicology studies with an aim to try to improve the health of Native American society, actually. And the other guest is Professor Bonnie Gunn. She's the forensic science advisor in the Department of Chemistry at the University of Texas at El Paso. And so we've got someone in the middle towards the upper end of her career, that's Bonnie, and we've got someone right at the beginning of her career, and it's going to be interesting to talk about these twin activities of forensics and toxicology. So welcome, Bonnie, and welcome, Vanessa.
Thank you. It's fun to be here. We'll see where it goes. It'll be interesting to see what Vanessa has at the beginning of her career, because I know where I've been.
Thanks. I'm excited to be here and excited to talk about toxicology and forensics, and it should be interesting.
Jolly good. Well, before we get into that topic, in terms of Vanessa here, you're very young. You just finished getting a PhD from the University of California at Berkeley, one of the pinnacles of scientific investigation around the world. Right. But before that, how did you decide it was going to be a scientific-oriented career?
Well, I guess it's been a long journey. But really, my interest in science started when I was really young.
You're all of 25 now, right?
Right. Well, it started in grade school, actually. I was a part of the recycling club, and I was very passionate about the environment. I just felt the need that I needed to save the environment, that was my goal. And that's sort of transformed through the years into, you know, doing a lot of science fairs, you know, studying chemistry. And ultimately, I became interested in chemistry in high school, and I had a very, very good chemistry teacher.
Tell us about the recycling club. You know, this is fourth grade, right?
So this is,
What did you recycle? You just went around looking for things, or was something in the school system?
So it was, you know, this is, you know, a club of fourth graders, and this was on campus at the elementary school. And Our goal was to increase awareness about recycling, so to put recycling bins in all the classrooms and make sure that, you know, we let students know that they should recycle and not, you know, throw stuff in the trash. And we'd also organize events around campus and the neighborhood to go and recycle, you know, pick up recyclables that we would see outside.
So this would be mainly Coke cans and
right,
paper.
Right, yeah,
at that
paper,
stage.
Coke cans. Right. You know, back then there weren't all these restrictions on, you know, soda and candy and all that, so there was definitely a lot of aluminum cans that we could recycle.
And did you trade them in for money? I know they used to have these little places where you could stuff Coke cans into some machine and it would regurgitate out quarters and things.
That's an excellent question. I don't know if we ever made any money off of our recycling adventure.
Maybe somebody else did.
I know.
How'd you
what
do
I'm starting
all
to
the
think
recycling
now.
Work?
Really, I know.
It's well, anyway, so that developed into a sort of a passion, as you said, for doing science fairs.
Yeah.
And so your interest then in the recycling club and then, you know, the environmental club led
right.
to science fairs. You then went to college, you studied chemistry, and then
right.
you decided rather than being a traditional chemist, you went in for this area of toxicology. Bonnie, toxicology is sort of a subdivision of forensic science. Am I correct to say that?
That's correct. There's actually the Society of Forensics Toxicology in the state of Texas, or SOFT.
So tell us a little bit first, Bonnie Gunn, what is forensic science? And then let's go over to Vanessa to talk about toxicological aspects.
Forensics, by definition, is the collection of material and using specific methods to analyze that data that you collect so that you can bring it to the law enforcement and it has statistical variance and importance. So we're looking at all areas of toxicology and all areas of science. I mean, there's the pathological as well as the chemical as well as the toxicological, which is primarily where we figure out if somebody's getting – there's something that's toxic that killed a person and what the relationship is to how they got it and where it came from and what it implies.
So forensics in North America is largely associated – well, greatly associated with debate. And so I suppose that's the same thing. If you're going to debate a topic, you gather the information, you assess it, and then you sort of try to figure out an argument based upon all that information. So – forensic science would be the gathering of the information and with an idea about how to then proceed in the future.
And how to bring it into law enforcement so that
– right.
Because most of the forensics now, if you say forensics to any person in current technology, current environment, their first thing is CSI, which has brought forensics into the forefront.
That's a television program?
It's a television program that has become extremely popular. There's original CSI, and then there's CSI New York, and there's CSI LA, and there's CSI New Orleans, and now there's CSI cyber technology. And these terminologies have now pervaded our young people, and forensic science is one of the hottest fields. And when you say forensics, they're looking at how you discover why and with the process by which someone was hurt, and then you take it to court, and it has to be debated, if you will, in court, whether the evidence is real or false.
I remember about a year and a half ago, I was given a book. It was called The Poisoner's Handbook, and it was by an author called Deborah Bloom. And basically, it was a story illustrating the beginning of toxicology and that type of forensic science in the world, but based in New York. There were two main characters. One was called Charles Norris, and he took over the job as the head of the examiner's office in New York. And he hired somebody called Alex Gettler, who was a toxicologist, who then started to devise all these sorts of tests for different types of poison, hence the name. Because, you know, in the 18th and 19th century, they'd use a lot of arsenic, right?
Yeah.
You know, and people would – there's all sorts of stories about arsenic and old lace. But the thing is that sooner or later, you can tell if someone's been killed by arsenic because there are certain chemical tests. And so, mm-hmm. therefore, the murderers got more clever. They started to use things like chloroform. You know, not so easy to tell about chloroform. So this book, the Poisoner's Handbook, is the history, and we've come a long way in basically a century. What's your particular interest in it? Why are you the advisor? What is it that you have as an interest in forensic science?
Well, I didn't start out in forensic science. I started out looking at how – actually, when I was doing my master's degree, I was looking at how insecticides kill particular types of bugs, if you will. It was funded by Dow Chemical Company, and I was very interested in how it worked. And the insecticide turned out to be very effective. The problem is it would also be effective against humans and crayfish and the lobsters and things because it hit chitin. Chitin is one of those proteins that's in the body. And so when I took a job that took me to Mexico, I worked closely with people who were involved in forensic science and instrumentation. And I saw the inference from scientific data that you had to have instrumentations with particular procedural information in place, and they had to be repeatable and the statistical importance. And that's where I kind of started to see that there's really a need at very, very low levels, and we are starting to detect at lower and lower and lower levels of all kinds of poisons and all kinds of scientific material that's out there.
We'll come back to that point because the instrumentation far outstrips, mm-hmm. in my opinion, scientific society to know what to do with the numbers that you get. Right? You'll always find a number for a concentration of arsenic, uranium, you name it, nasty things, but they're always there. And it's just a question of if we can go lower and lower in detection, but what does that mean, you know, for action? So, Vanessa, you're in this forensic science, but you chose a particular subfield, so forensic toxicology. Tell us what you understand by toxicology.
Well, for me, I'm, by training, a molecular toxicologist. So I'm interested really in what goes on in the cells, in our cells, and how chemicals that are not endogenous to our bodies, how those chemicals interact with our cells and lead to, you know, adverse health effects.
And there's millions of chemicals out there.
Right.
So how do you choose the target that you want to look at?
Well, you know, for me, this goes back to my interest, which is the environment. And I'm interested in chemicals that are prevalent in the environment. And that's because us as humans are constantly exposed to these chemicals. And so what are the implications of, you know, being exposed for decades to, you know, arsenic or lead or solvents? Because we don't know a lot of these chemicals, we don't know what the implications are of long-term exposure.
So if you were to start your own research group, you would simply say, well, let me sort of get an analysis of what chemicals we use, which ones persist, which ones have highest concentrations close to population centers, and then go from there?
Right. So, for example, right now the work that I'm doing at the University of New Mexico, we have a strong interest in arsenic and uranium because they're very high levels in New Mexico and throughout the Southwest. And so those two metals have, you know, high impacts on the surrounding communities, which are usually Native American communities.
But they've been around forever, right? I mean, in fact, I remember a science project that one of my sons did with the drinking water in El Paso.
Right.
And it goes back to the previous point. We started to do analysis of uranium, and sooner or later you come up with a number.
Right.
And so then the child goes to a science fair and says, oh, there's all this uranium in the drinking water. Well, we know that it's such a small level that it's not particularly important. I suppose I can say that. But other people, they don't. They say, oh, my God, we're drinking uranium. But there's not a drop of water that anybody drinks in the world that hasn't got some small quantities of these elements almost.
Right. So, yeah, so you're right. So there are very small, in some areas, there are going to be very small quantities. And sort of our job is to understand what the implications are of very small quantities, right? Because we do know.
Over long term.
But we do know that being exposed to uranium or arsenic or lead in a very high dose, I mean, we already know that the hazards of that. But really what we're interested in now is understanding over time how these chemicals are interacting with our bodies and what the results of that are.
Well, let's pursue that. How do you do such an experiment? I mean, because the body presumably is constantly finding methodologies to get, you know, your kidneys filter things and remove all of these nasty toxins. How do you do the experiment over long term? What is long term? A year? 10 years?
Right. So that's something that is difficult. It's difficult to make that assessment because you really want to look across generations, right? You want to be able to see if I'm exposed to something, does this have implications for my kids, for my grandkids? And we don't know that for a lot of chemicals. And that is something that people are interested in studying but is difficult to study.
So you're looking for genetic modifications within groups of people within families, for example. So you're talking about Native Americans that live in an area with high arsenic concentrations, presumably.
Right. So,
and are you able, or is the plan then, to start looking at genetic modifications?
No, our research isn't really focused on looking at these genetic modifications or genetic changes. We're mostly just interested in understanding what are the hazards that are associated with, you know, living in an environment that is contaminated with various levels of these metals. And so our work is a bit more focused on understanding just toxic endpoints like cancer or kidney issues, other...
So let me see if I understand this. What you're saying is that for a population that's subjected to a particular level of a particular environmental hazard, we'll say uranium and arsenic because that's what you brought up, are we trying to find hot spots of different diseases? Is that the idea that, we see a lot of kidney disease in this area? We see a lot of cancer of the bladder, for example. Is that one part of this process?
That is definitely a part of toxicological studies. There are groups that are interested in investigating these in what we call, you know, hot spots. Certainly, there's interest in understanding why these hotspots exist. And so our work isn't necessarily focused on whether or not there's a hotspot of, you know, cancer or whatever, you know, in this community. But there are people that are interested in that.
We'll come back to that point. You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. I'm here with Professor Bonnie Gunn, who is the Forensic Science Advisor in Chemistry at the University of Texas at El Paso, and Dr. Vanessa De La Rosa from the University of New Mexico, and we'll be back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog.
And I'm Dr. David Niesel. In late 2014, President Obama issued an executive order to better track and prevent illnesses caused by superbugs. No, not insects, but antibiotic-resistant bacteria.
These superbugs and new ones rank among the top challenges of our century. One U.S. senator wants to create a federal office dedicated to antimicrobial resistance.
Are they being alarmist? Unfortunately not. For example, in 2012, 450,000 cases of multiple drug-resistant tuberculosis were diagnosed, and many strains of Neisseria gonorrhea are now resistant to antibiotics of last resort, meaning there are no treatments left.
How about developing better drugs? Only a handful of the big pharmaceuticals now do the work and may require decades for new antibiotics to reach patients. So it's imperative to slow antibiotic resistance and find the cause.
The first problem is that bacteria adapt and evolve easily. Second is the problem of antibiotic overuse. Think of times when you took an antibiotic not knowing that you really had a bacterial infection.
Critically ill patients are often prescribed multiple antibiotics, which unfortunately can help generate new superbugs. So some hospitals now enforce stricter guidelines.
Another problem, which accounts for over half the use of antibiotics, is the livestock industry. It's given to control infections and to promote weight gain, but many countries now ban this practice.
The U.S. is only asking for voluntary compliance, but in order to turn the tide, we need better surveillance, research, and perhaps laws so we're not faced with sick children whose infections we cannot fight.
We are Drs. David Neisel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Professor Bonnie Gunn, Forensic Science Advisor at UT El Paso, and Dr. Vanessa De La Rosa from the University of New Mexico. Vanessa, you were talking that your interest is in the sort of the health of the current population is impacted by arsenic and uranium concentrations. But you earlier said that you're interested in also, or maybe I just misunderstood it, toxicologists in general were more interested in the long-term impact over generations. How
right.
do you put those two things together?
Our work is not necessarily interested in looking at transgenerational effects. That is a topic in the field of toxicology that is of high interest because there is evidence to suggest that chemicals can have impacts well after initial exposure. And so that there are chemicals that can sort of have epigenetic effects. What are the effects of these changes in epigenetics? We don't really know. And there's a field in toxicology that is interested in investigating that or researching that.
Just give for the audience and myself again a refresher. I know what genetics are, but epigenetics?
So epigenetics is the change or modifications of DNA that results in changes in expression of genes. So, for example, our DNA can be methylated, and that signals certain genes to be expressed, so either upregulated or downregulated.
So it's a knowledge of what is happening when DNA is modified.
Mm-hmm.
Epigenetics means an investigation of what follows from that particular modification?
So epigenetics is just, that's the term that's used to describe that process of the DNA or histones being modified, and that results in changes in gene expression. And so that's epigenetics.
Bonnie, tell us a little bit about the thrust of the forensic science program here at UT El Paso. What are some of the areas that people are studying?
Well, at our university, because we have an undergraduate program in forensics that is chemistry concentrated as well as one that is concentrated in the biological fields, because those are the two great needs of most forensic science at this point. Those are the ones that you can be hired to do in the biological world. They're going to be looking.
You actually get a job.
Right, right. And the biological world is the ones that are looking at the biological impacts of forensics as it applies to the law, as it applies to someone being killed or processed the information from the biological point of view, bugs and things like that. Where chemistry is looking at the toxicological effects that occur in DNA that result in someone dying, arsenic, for example, or being killed by other methods with chemical impact. And those are live breathalyzers, someone being killed, for example, driving a car because he was drunk.
What's that going to do with forensic science?
Forensic science, they use the forensic science to measure the alcohol content.
So this is development of tests.
Right, it's developments of tests that will lead to identification of particular states or limits that are acceptable or not acceptable within society, i.e. alcohol. Once you pass that point, you are sent if you're pulled over and your indications, and then you have to have your blood tests, and they know the percent of alcohol. And then if you're classified as over drunk, then
I mean, we already know what those limits are,
right?
So what's the new research, the new sort of activity and knowledge that we're generating in that type of analysis?
Well, mostly, particularly in that area, we're getting to the point where we can have different kinds of tests because we know what the volume of the lungs are, and there's easier, faster methodologies that give us information. And that's where the technology is moving faster and easier techniques to allow us to define.
I remember once I was pulled over in New Mexico and accused wrongly of driving while intoxicated. My car had slipped off the mountain, so it was careless at least, but I wasn't inebriated.
Right.
But they took me in and then gave me a blood test, and it took forever. And it would have been much better if it had just been an instantaneous, then they could have let me go. But I had to spend the night in jail simply because the damn test was so long and they were convinced that I was culpable. So I'm all in favor of instantaneous tests.
I'm in favor of instantaneous tests for a lot of reasons. And blood alcohol is just one of the multitude of tests that are out there. And trying to find a way that you can, i.e., make sure that someone has been drinking versus some other medical effect that they have. So if their tests come back positive, then they're taken in for a blood test, and that's what happens when you're testing.
So, Vanessa, back to Dr. De La Rosa. When you were in Berkeley, what were some of the big other areas of toxicological research that were active?
Well, so at Berkeley, we had a small toxicology department, but there was definitely a lot of toxicological research that was ongoing throughout the campus. And some of the exciting work that was going on was also related to arsenic and looking at arsenic exposure and what the implications of that are related to cancer. And so we had groups that were doing work in other areas of the world, like Chile, where there's high arsenic exposure, and doing studies there with the communities to study adverse health effects in those communities.
So it's the same old culprits. I'm an inorganic chemist. I like arsenic. I love lead. All right, and to me, these are two elements that I have a bit of a passion for. All right, and yet they've got this terrible reputation, and everybody keeps on and on studying. Haven't we learned enough? We don't want lead in the water. We don't want children eating the dirt with the lead. We don't want smelters pumping out lead. End of discussion. Now let's move to, I don't know, fluorinated hydrocarbons or the ozone hole or, you see what I'm getting at? What's this fixation with lead and arsenic?
Because they're so prevalent and pose a variety of health hazards that we still don't understand. I think we know that metals, certain metals like arsenic, can result in cancer. We know that. But I think there's still a lot to be learned. I still think that there are a lot of other health implications that we just don't know about.
And do we know what, I mean, arsenic for the listener is just one element directly underneath phosphorus. So you go to that famous group 15, and we've got at the top nitrogen, phosphorus, arsenic, antimony, and bismuth. Strange names, I'm sure, to the audience. But arsenic is very similar to phosphorus. Phosphates are all over the body. Everything, all the energy we get comes from cleavage of phosphates and recombinations and things of this nature. Is arsenic sort of toxic because it can substitute for phosphorus in say, DNA?
I'm not aware of any work that shows arsenic can replace phosphorus in biological processes.
Okay.
I think arsenic or metals in general are toxic because they have the ability to change oxidation states and alter, metal homeostasis in cells, right? And metals, for people, who may not be familiar, are actually very important in a lot of cellular processes.
Oh, I tell my classes all the time.
Right.
People call carbon the element of life, but without zinc, without iron, without copper, these are really quite important.
Right. So metals play a really important role in maintaining our cells, and there's a very delicate balance of these metals in our cells. And when you alter them with exogenous metals, then you have issues and you disrupt that balance.
I do know that lead, for example, has the capacity to replace zinc in the so-called zinc fingers in different proteins. When zinc sort of holds the conformation of a protein mm-hmm. into a little loop, sometimes lead can get in there, mm-hmm. substitute, and then there are subtle changes of size
right.
and function.
So that's related to the work that we're doing at the University of New Mexico, where we're looking at how arsenic can replace zinc in certain zinc fingers.
Arsenic can replace zinc?
Right, yeah. So what we are looking at is arsenic replacing zinc in very specific zinc fingers and how that alters the function of those proteins that are very important in repairing our DNA.
Okay, so it's a long way, in fact, then from what I might call the direct translational result of improving the health of the nation or improving the health of your Native American.
Well, I mean, I don't think so because... So, for example, you know, arsenic replacing zinc in proteins, this has implications for whether or not, you know, the DNA is being repaired correctly. And if your DNA is, you know, not being repaired correctly and you're increasing mutations in your DNA, I mean, that ultimately has, you know, health implications.
Bad effects.
Yes.
I can see that. What's your future goal? Okay, you're at the beginning. You're doing what is called a postdoctoral fellowship. You've got 4 years with this postdoctoral fellowship. Then what's the next stage in the development of a young scientist?
For me, my career goal tends to change. And certainly, when I started my graduate career and entered into my postdoctoral fellowship, my goal has been to do research, continue doing research, but also to teach. I enjoy teaching. I have a passion for teaching. I enjoy engaging with students. And so for me, I'm hoping to pursue a career that is heavy in teaching.
Okay.
And
don't make it too heavy. too heavy a load of teaching, and it's difficult. Bonnie, what's your career goal?
My career goal right now is to see if we can increase the enrollment in forensic science and chemistry and make sure that our students here at UTEP, particularly we want to increase the graduation rate for forensics and populate the forensics field from our point of view.
I don't have any career goals. I'm quite happy as I am at the moment, which is probably not good. Anyway, you've been listening to Science Studio. We've had Professor Bonnie Gunn from the Department of Chemistry, who is the Forensic Science Advisor in Chemistry at the university here, and Dr. Vanessa De La Rosa from the University of New Mexico, who's doing some interesting new research to try to sort of learn a little bit more about the direct impact of environmental hazards like arsenic and uranium, the good old topics, on the human body. Totally worthy types of research area, and maybe in 10 years you'll come back and you'll tell us what you've done in your first academic career. I'd like to thank Belinda Fernandez for stepping in this morning, and thank you very much for being here, and we'll see you again next week.